Welcome back to the Chats with Creatives podcast. I'm your host, Bronte Charlotte, and today I am speaking with the glorious Nick Clark. We are traveling down a different path today, folks. We're delving into the taboo land of leaving the creative industries. While we spend a fair bit of time talking about the industry and Nick's experience of it, we also chat about our personal experiences of the Australian education system, mental health, gardening, and the power of plants. Nick was an actor before he made the choice to take a step back from the creative industries and study psychology. You'll hear throughout this chat how insightful and articulate Nick is. His budding psychologist aura feels like this big, enveloping hug of non-judgment, joy, understanding, and intelligence. Speaking with Nick about human behavior and psychology is fascinating. I'm always learning from him and discovering new ways of thinking about things. We chat about the importance of empathy, different ways of defining yourself, and the types of changes that need to happen within society to remove the stigma of mental health. We dig deep into Nick's transition out of acting, the moments that brought him to his decision, and how his life has changed since. I just want to quickly let you know that at moments we do mention suicide in relation to mental health and talk pretty openly about our own experiences of anxiety and depression. So if this is not something that you are feeling up to diving into today, perhaps come back to the episode at a later date. As always, I want to acknowledge that I'm recording this podcast on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Let's jump in. Nick Clark.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Hello.
So this is different to my usual chats because all of the people so far that I've spoken to have actively been a part of the creative industries in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And you were.
Yes.
And made a decision to kind of travel in a different direction.
Correct.
Yes. So that's kind of what we're going to be delving into. And
lovely.
I'm so excited because I think it's a really important thing for people in creative spaces to kind of hear experiences that others have gone through.
Mm-hmm.
Decisions that others have made, and to also remove the stigma that I think surrounds people leaving in inverted commas a creative space or the creative arts or a career in acting or whatever it may be.
So do I need to curtail the swearing? Am I allowed to keep swearing?
You can swear.
Okay, brilliant.
Also, who says curtail? You, apparently. Like,
literally me.
I almost feel like I need to Google its meaning.
Curtail.
Guess what it means, but I've never said it.
To curtail something is just like to shorten or to like rein it in. Yeah, I don't know. I used it in a sentence already for you. So to me, it's the equivalent of saying like rein it in.
Great.
So like you might curtail your swearing or you might curtail it. Like, I think it's more about reining in something you're doing. If you want to look it up, I'm intrigued now because I've just been using this word for years. And I'm probably completely wrong.
Wouldn't reduce in extent or quantity.
There you go.
Impose a restriction on. So you there used you it very well.
Yeah, thank you.
I just had never heard the word before.
Look, if anything, I think my both vocabulary and vernacular.
Vocabulary?
Yeah, that's the word it is. Vocabulary. both are like, as I get older, becoming more and more eclectic. Like I'm just getting more and more specific. And then people are like, what do you mean? And I'm like,
I didn't learn that in school.
Yeah, they're just like, that wasn't in Harry Potter, so I don't care. It's like, oh, shit.
I don't know if I've told you this, but I've been reading my like teenage year favorite books since December. And so far I've read 12 of them in like a month because I'm obsessed.
But they're also so enjoyable and so nostalgic.
So nostalgic.
What are they? What are some of the faves?
Well, the thing is they're all part of the same world. They just follow different characters and they are...
What are these books?
They're by Tamora Pierce.
Right.
And they're like medieval fantasy.
Yeah, they are.
young adult fiction.
Beautiful.
But the thing is and I've realized this as I've gone back to them, is that every single one of them, so they're kind of, they're written in quartets. So there's like four books in each, but then they all, just in case so, you didn't know.
Yeah, sorry, vocabulary, quartet. So there's four of them.
So in each one, they follow a character. Mm. Every single one of them, the lead is a female.
Right.
In the first quartet, she's the first female knight in the realm.
Cool.
In the second one, she's a female mage. And then in the third, she's the second female knight. So she's like, so in the first one, the knight, the woman, Alana, she was hiding that she was a woman.
Right.
And then so in the next quartet about the female knight, she's the first openly female woman training to be a knight.
Which, funnily enough, parallels a lot of experiences of
women
throughout things. Like the women instant studying one for me.
And
studying writers, especially.
Yes.
Like during the time of the what's George Eliot's actual name? She wrote The Mill and the Floss.
They had to go under
Marianne Evans is her real name. Oh. But George Eliot, Mill and the Floss, like important book of that era, published under a male name. Also, isn't that, and as much as I'm not a huge fan of her for other reasons, but same reason, like J.K. Rowling, I think went by J.K.
Yes.
was, and despite we don't want to give air to transphobes, but the reason why she went by J.K. was because it would soften. People wouldn't assume the gender of the author. So, and because it was about a male protagonist primarily, meant that boys would read it and people wouldn't feel like, oh, this is a book for girls.
So fucked. There's so many fucked things in that.
Sexism is rife.
Yes. Anyway, these books, they all have female leads and they're all like incredibly strong and they fight for what they want and...
A chilling prediction of what you're doing with your life now.
No, it's just like they, I guess in a way, like they were the books that I was reading in like formative years for me. I mean, I did read Harry Potter and that was like a male protagonist, but like these all had female protagonists and she was surrounded generally. She wasn't is the character would be surrounded by men and she would always like successfully show her strength and her power in like many different ways. I don't know. It was just like
question within the books, obviously, because I haven't read them. Does it make a, this is sort of an interesting question of where certain feminist rhetoric and theories at. Did it make a point of her, like, was it about the woman overcoming and being successful, or was it just a woman being successful? Do you think the gender was centered in some of the stories, or was
the
gender is
definitely centered in the stories about like the female knights?
Yep. Okay.
Because they were non-existent and they weren't allowed to become warriors.
Yeah.
But then after the character has set that standard or like that as something that women could do, in the following novels, female warriors were just a part of the story.
That's cool.
Yeah. So
that's cool. That's
it was really
so
cool,
good.
And it's also like. Like I remember when I was first reading them, my younger brother was also reading them. Mm. And for me, it was like where I learned about periods properly.
Yeah.
In like, you know, a novel about a woman in like medieval times. Because at school or, you know, with family discussions, it wasn't.
The fact that like I have very strong opinions on sexual education.
Oh my God,
I have very strong
as
opinions on everything at the moment.
Yeah.
But sexual education in Australia is shocking.
It's
like
fucking woeful.
I've asked not every single person I've ever met, but I've asked so many people. I'm like, did you get taught about any form of queer sex? Did you get taught about the actual reproductive cycle, inclusive of a period and what that is? Or was it all like hushed down, made jokes of because it was the bloody PE teacher teaching it who was sort of
literally
making jokes
though,
and blah, blah, blah.
Literally my PE teacher.
And like I remember our major assignment was to do a PowerPoint presentation about an STI. And I'm like, yes, STIs are important, but my knowledge of ancient people that got syphilis is so much less important than like, you know, even as a male, like understanding how a period works, like there's so much, like
consent.
Fuck. Like
the big thing that's like literally laughed about in class.
Yeah.
Oh,
Is having explicit consent with someone. And that to me is a real blight and a real stain. I mean, Australian education up until a tertiary level, even at a tertiary level, there are issues, but there's so many areas where they don't actually interrogate what the important real world implications of how this is dealt with is. The other example would be bloody Indigenous history. I think they glossed over the First Fleet And, you know, it was probably like a couple of years ago that I learned that statistic, which is like within X amount of years of since colonization, 90% of the Aboriginal population within Australia was wiped out. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something that should be taught alongside these things.
The gravity that it deserves to be taught with, not with a lightness or a light touch or like, let's make this a bit softer because they're young children. It's like, no, this needs to be enforced. And
also, like, 12-year-olds are watching The Hunger Games, you know? We understand that war is part of our world. We understand that death is part of our world. And in reality as well, it's like when you actually engaging with those topics doesn't necessarily instigate them or increase them or things like that. It's that whole idea that it's like if kids play violent video games, they're going to display more violent behaviors. When they've tested that idea in actuality, yes, there is slightly less pro-social behavior immediately afterwards, but it doesn't overall change the person into a more violent person unless they already had an inclination that way. So regardless, it's like it's sort of that thing of if someone was going to do it, yes, they might gravitate towards that, but it doesn't have a causal relationship there. So it's like teaching children about racism actually has the inverse effect. Mm. Like being exposed to this is the best way that we can actually change our society and change our world and change our relationship to these things.
I 100% agree. It's interesting though, because I've talked about this a few times with different people that have been on the podcast, and I, as a white woman that grew up in like middle class Queensland and not having a proper education around it, like my learning of this stuff started when I left home and when I moved into state and when I started my own personal journey of like learning about our true history.
Which is what, your early 20s was when you started?
18. Yeah. 18, 19.
Okay, right. Yeah. Which I would argue is earlier than some people.
I think so. I think that this, particularly with Indigenous history in Australia and around the world, and also sex education, I think that maybe there's something about the fact that you went to school in Tasmania and I went to school in Queensland that kind of enforced that lack of education around those specific things. Yeah. Because I've spoken to people who went to school in Victoria and a few of them actually disagree with me, thinking that the Australian education system actually spent a fair amount of time on Indigenous history. And I don't think that that is my experience is that that's not what happened for me. And I think that there is space for more education for sure.
Or
but I have been fought on this point.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, whoever's making those comments probably right in their own individualized experience, the same way yours is.
That's it, right?
Like, so it's more about finding a higher standardized level so it isn't either left up to individual states or in a lot of instances, individual schools valuing this, that there actually are sort of, you know, and I'm fairly sure, and I'm very willing to be wrong on this, but like in the Gonski report, that was part of it. It's like the standards of teaching across Australia, because we're a huge country with quite a small population, but very spread out, which poses like just logistical challenges, means that there's a lot of inconsistency. You know, for instance, I was up in Brisbane and I was asking about the high schools because obviously very different to Launceston, which is what, town of like 80,000 now, but probably about 75,000 when I was growing up. So my parents sent me to private school, not because we could afford it. We were all on scholarships, which was the only way we could go, but because of the discrepancy in education levels between the public and the private system within that town. But the reality is then that's a huge like economic question. I'd say now it's changed a little bit that some – I'd say one of the colleges is quite good in terms of education, but overall there's still quite a discrepancy between education levels and standards and topics and emphasis. And the reality is then that just poses an economic barrier to people. And, you know, for individuals, it comes up to your parents and it comes up to them making the choice of whether they're going to internally sacrifice financially for your education, which is the decision that my parents made. Yeah, it's a huge problem. That,
do you know what is scary about that as well? In the UK, laws have changed so that parents can pull their students out of sex education classes.
So
it's no longer up to the child. Their education is never up to them, essentially. But like,
absolutely not.
A parent can decide if you learn about your own sexual health or not.
The reality is, I am not like, I am an atheist as an individual. However, I have respect for all religions, assuming that they're non-violent. The reality is I learned more about the Catholic and Anglican religions through my schooling than I did about sexual education. Now, I'm someone that doesn't practice. I haven't been to church since I went to school. You know, it doesn't have a huge part of my world and my daily life. However, sex does. Consent does. All of these things do. And yet because the systems are written from a conservative viewpoint, they just go, oh, this is something I can opt in and opt out of. Everyone should learn about consent. Full stop. Like, in every regard.
I told you to listen to the Pleasure podcast, didn't I?
I did.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. How? I listened to the, and I really liked it.
Oh my God, it's so good.
And I thought, yeah. And I was
That's literally like, I feel like my proper sex education started last year when I started listening to that. Because it is just like,
yeah,
so good.
Yeah. And I guess the thing that's interesting is that they deal with or discuss all of the facets of sexuality rather than, for want of a better phrase, the nuts and bolts. Or just being like, this is how to put a condom
and
on a cucumber.
Also with such openness.
Yeah.
Like there's literally no judgment, which then allows you to listen without judgment.
Well, because the reality is, and this is something I really feel about education, is they treat, like, it's a very homogenized experience. And so everyone is treated the same. And the reality is, you know, you're sitting in a room with other individuals who are going to have really specific experiences. You know, you actually need to cover and understand what those are rather than judgmentally pick what people should or shouldn't engage with. I have a huge qualm with the way that addiction is, because in most instances, addiction isn't taught in schools. In the second instance, when it is, it doesn't talk about the lead up or addictive behavior or, you know, the importance of being able to talk about these sort of things. It's all hidden and either implied or expected to be implicitly understood or treated as, oh, this is something the parents should deal with. However, I fully believe that if you equip people with the knowledge to do something before it hits crisis point, it always ends up better. Like, I am so thankful, this is specifically with regards to my own mental health, that I was 17 or 18 was the first time I went to see a psychologist or a therapist. And that was because my brother has quite a complex history of mental health. I spoke with him about some stuff that was going on and he was like, you should go. And fortunately, we have quite a good headspace in Launceston still, which, like, you know, therein lies the benefit of being in a slightly larger regional city, not quite a regional town, meaning that I had free access to people who could help me in the position that I was without judgment and equip me with skills that I still deal with today. So that's, you know, that's important. I don't think that unbiased or unjudgmental education has enough sway in the way that we teach people, well, in this country, but in most conservatively run countries, you know.
And then kids essentially are left to, like, if people aren't being educated and in a non-judgmental way learning about things that human beings go through, then you're left to deal with it on your own. And that's when mental health can crash and you don't understand what's going on around you. Like, me personally, not similar experience, but like in the same vein, like my older brother had addiction issues through high school and I didn't have a way to deal with that and nor did my younger brother. And so we then in turn would lash out in our own different ways to try and deal with what we were experiencing kind of secondhand with our older brother, with, you know, not being told what was going on and then just guessing about things. And then also, like, not being let into the fact that, like, he was suicidal and, like, we just had this kind of sideline experience of what was going on. And then my mom, as a single mother, was dealing with everything as well as dealing with her own fucking life with having to mother three children and all of this stuff. But, like, if we had good education and, like, proper in-depth education, moving on now to, like, mental health in schools, with, like, so teenagers can fucking learn about this stuff and how your brain functions and what's going on, then there's tools that you can use and learn at a young age, which is especially needed for people who are dealing with stuff that don't have a way to deal with it.
Well, and what you're pointing out there that I think is really important is that even if you individually are not directly affected by something, so say, for example, addiction, the other classic example for me is depression, suicide, all of these things actually affect a large portion of people. I think I'm probably wrong here, but I think this current statistic is, you know, over 50% of Australians will interact with mental health at some point in their life, whether that be through a loved one, through a partner, through family members, through someone at work, all of those sort of things. So even if you aren't directly implicated or affected by whatever that circumstance is, you still have to understand it and you still have to engage with it. I think so many conversations in my life have been with people who don't understand what it is for someone to want to commit suicide, don't understand what it is for someone to have depression, don't understand what it is to have anxiety, and they look at the external behaviors and go, oh, I don't understand what they're doing. And then they attribute certain either causal implications. They go, oh, well, maybe I did something that caused them to do this. Or conversely, they make judgmental calls about the person and they go, well, they're doing this because of this, this, this. It's the classic thing, and I will use my grandmother as this example because I'm very proud of where she's come in terms of mental health stuff. When sort of both my brother and myself had sort of mental health moments or mental health situations that, you know, really did require some level of intervention, her initial reaction, keeping in mind as well, she's in her late 80s now, so that sort of pictures her in terms of the generation. Initially, whilst caring, it was very much like, you know, you need to go for a walk, you need to start eating healthily, everyone gets sad, it's something you can work through, all of this sort of stuff, which to a degree is true. All of those behaviors can foster better mental health. However, they don't replace actual intervention and actual work, really. You know, you can't walk away depression. You can't pretend away suicidal tendencies. They're things that actually do really need to be engaged with. It's the same as if someone had, you know, stage whatever cancer and then you just went, well, it's actually better for you if you eat healthily, which again is true. It puts your body in a better position to fight the cancer cells. However, it's not going to fix the overall problem, or it's not going to teach you or equip you with the skills to engage with something that quite possibly may be part of your entire life. And so now she has much more of that relationship. She's like, this is something that, you know, they're going through, or this is something that is part of them. It's not a malfunction. It's not a blight. It's not something to be embarrassed about. It's just part of them. It's part of the natural extension of who they are as a person. And what's most important is that I can support them in the specific way they need support when they need it. Not putting my own experience onto them and going, well, when, you know, when I feel a bit down, I go for a walk and I feel better. And it's brilliant that, you know, if you are a person that has that sort of capacity. But for some people, that just doesn't work. You know, the classic question, well, the classic thing someone said to me, and I was like, that's so true, is like, I think their mum had said, oh, well, you need to start exercising every day. And they just asked them, they're like, how am I meant to exercise every day if I can't get out of bed? Which is, you know, is a reality for some people. And I think education about what the experience feels like, what you can do to help, what behaviors you can encourage, again, you know, as I was saying before, is always of benefit. It's always good to equip people with the skills to actually engage with something, whether it be directly because it's affecting themselves or indirectly because it's affecting people they care about.
I caught up with a friend this morning who I had this experience with a couple of years ago where I was incredibly anxious, like clinically anxious, and their response was to tell me what I needed in the friendship, and that was for them to leave it. Whereas that triggered me immensely because that was part of my anxiety, was that no one wanted to be around me and people didn't want to be my friend. And then they were like, okay, so you're dealing with something. I don't understand what's going on with you. So you need to sort that out. I'm leaving. Please. Anyway, that's like, doesn't matter. But like that happened this morning where we had a discussion about that. And I was like, that's not how anxiety works.
Yeah.
You don't need to like do anything for a person with anxiety. You just need to like say,
but in that circumstance, if you know, and to respect their autonomy as a person as well.
Absolutely.
If they'd gone, hey, I see that you're going through something at the moment. What's the best thing I can do to help that? Or to frame it and go, maybe at the time that was bringing up something in them, maybe that was something that they were finding really difficult.
Mm.
And rather being honest and going, at times I find it really difficult to deal with this, but I really value you as a person. Mm. I really value our friendship. What's a way that we can, you know, move forward and work together?
Or instead of saying what you need is space from me,
yeah,
whether that's because they think that they're causing anxiety or whatever it may be, like, yeah, it's to ask the question and be like, what do you need? What is it that we can work on? Or like, do you need space?
Yeah. Well, yeah, entirely. Like, it's the, you know, there's the assumption that it's like, oh, you need space, so I'm going to back out.
Yeah.
Rather going, what do you need? Mm. And how can I provide that in a way that's safe for me?
Mm.
To go for another example, and I obviously won't use this person's name, did have someone reasonably close to me attempt suicide during the first lockdown. They'd had a really horrible set of circumstances leading up to it. Subsequently, you're in the house by yourself, and you know that was the result. They told me about a week afterwards, and I went through, you know, the benefit of someone who's studying psychology explicitly is A, it's less intimidating to talk about these things, but B, you're equipped with some knowledge, not everything. I'm not a qualified psychologist at this point. That's X amount of years down the track. But, you know, I was still, you know, you ask how they're getting callbacks in, you understand that talking about attempting suicide doesn't increase the risk of actually doing it. You ask, and this one's a really big one for a lot of people, is ask that person if ever they hit that point again, make them promise to call you. Mm. And to say, you know, if you hit that point, if you're starting to feel like that, I want you to call me. Because what that does is it actually puts a blockage or a redirect in the pathway of events, and it forces them to reach out to another person.
Mm.
And quite often, if you're someone they've divulged that information to, you are someone they really care about or someone whose opinion they really do care about. So making that promise to each other is really important. Anyway, that person's going brilliantly now. But part of it, part of what we had and why I bring up this example was obviously that's a really huge thing that they've gone through. Mm. It's also a big thing for me to go through. So we know and we explicitly agreed upon that if they had something that was really heavy or was really difficult or was something that was, you know, more in that realm of experience and not just sort of, hey, how are you going? They would message me first, usually because they were going to call me. They'd message me. They'd say, I need to talk to you about something really serious. When's a good time for you?
Mm.
So it meant that I knew what was coming. So I had time to emotionally prepare myself. Mm. So, you know, I wouldn't be at work or I wouldn't be about to go and do something. Or if I'd had a really, really hard day, I could give myself the time to be the, you know, best friend and the best support that I could be. But we had that buffer and it meant I knew what I was getting into and how to engage with it. And I think people, once again, going back to education, people aren't taught that they do have autonomy and they do have power and they can help. You don't need to be, you know, qualified in anything to help another person. You just need to be a human. But what we do need is the skill set and the understanding of how to make clear boundaries that allows us to support someone through, you know, quite often really difficult times. Mm. And, you know, life is not easy. This year certainly hasn't been easy on a lot of people. But, you know, we all have an incredible capacity to help and to, you know, really make an impact and really change the course of people's experiences with, you know, both mental health but also just the average everyday experiences of life.
So how did we meet, Nick?
How did we meet? We met at the Victorian College of the Arts.
I know.
In the year 2016.
It's true.
I was good friends with a previous podcast interviewer, being the incredible, remarkable, multi-talented, complex and beautiful Rebecca Hill.
Indeed.
And subsequently she sort of went, there's this incredible person who I know from Brisbane and she's in first year. And then I think I saw you in Synthesis, which for anyone who hasn't been to VCA is a project that I think it may not exist at this point.
It doesn't. I'm so sure that it doesn't.
But at the time it was meant to be a performance that was made and synthesized of your first weeks at VCA and to speak exactly to where you were in the world at that moment. And I thought you were amazing and you thought you were terrible. And I think that's, I think that was one of the first like conversations we had, because I was like, oh my God, you were so good.
And I was like, that was like, yeah, you literally were like, the most embarrassing thing I've ever done in my life.
Would have rather pull out each of my toenails individually with my own teeth.
Oh, it was so bad. But that's very sweet.
First year drama school, huh?
I feel like that's quite often the general experience, is that you do something and you're like, I wish I didn't have to. And other people watch and they're like, that was fine. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah. But yes, that's how we met.
That is how we met. Fucking fly.
The fly is my favorite addition to this.
There's a fly that's just decided to be a part of this conversation.
It's also bringing movement. It's bringing flair.
It's bringing extra all of this sweat, like flicks of sweat just like dripping off my hand as I try to bat it away.
Just,
oh my God, it's very warm in this room. I'm currently
being interviewed by a sprinkler and it's very enjoyable.
So we did meet at the VCA.
We did.
And that was when you were in third year, I do believe. I'm curious, what drew you to the creative arts to begin with? Because I'm curious if there
because
was...
Because I was prolifically good. Because I was incredibly talented. Because I was really, the greatest really artistic presence you had ever seen in your life.
I'm curious if it was like, did you have this desire to perform, or did you just have this interest in human behavior? Because you are now studying psychology, and correct, that link of like psychology and acting is a strong one for many people, I think. But there's just this general interest in human behavior that I know I felt when I did my 6 months of psych in like 2013. Yep. And that's kind of like what made me think that that could be a good option for me, was this interest in just human beings and how we function.
Yeah, so I was absolutely the type of kid that was putting on performances and things at home and just dragging my relatives at Christmas to watch me do stuff. And I had the great good fortune of a mother who recognized that and supported that. So I, very early on, on the mainland, revealing my Tasmanian heritage, on the mainland, I think they're commonly referred to as a Steadfords. But in Launceston, they were known as the Launceston Competitions, which are one of the oldest running Steadfords in Australia. And I entered that for the first time in my life when I was in prep.
Wow.
So I was in prep and I entered in the poetry, in the recital section.
Oh my God.
And I came second.
Such a clever little boy.
Thank you. Thank you. And so then the next year I did it again and I would do reasonably well. And I remember, and I was talking to my mum at Christmas about this, and we remember vehemently and aggressively arguing, because mum would be watching, as you know, as any good director is watching the performer and is trying to elicit the best performance. And as any sort of young creative knows, they know everything and they know exactly how it's meant to be done. So it was fully that dynamic for years and years and years and years. And so I did pretty well at them sort of through that. And then into high school, I did, I mean, I did really well at them, and the categories expanded. So you'd do the recital, you would do an impromptu reading, you would do a prepared reading, you'd do a monologue, you'd do a duologue, you'd do all of these sort of things. There are all these sections. Still, for me, one of my proudest things I ever achieved, which is odd in hindsight, but was for 2 years in a row, there's the highest award in those competitions was the Award for Artistic Excellence, which could go to anyone in any category. And usually it went to like, you know, someone in year 12 or someone who would probably go on to go to a drama school. And I won that. I was the youngest ever person to win that. And I won it in year 9 and year 10 under two separate adjudicators. And over that time, I became really good friends with these, you know, incredible like elderly women who ran the competition. So that was sort of the genesis of performance. I hit my year 12 exams and I was in a production of Sweeney Todd. And the 2 weeks of exams was the same 2 weeks that the show was performing. So I was literally, you know, before the show, reading essays and then going and sitting my exams in the day. And I realized for me that what was getting me through this academic side, which was something I was very successful at objectively, was the creative output. So I went, oh my God, I should be an actor. So I deferred all my offers for uni. I was like, right, I'm going to audition for drama schools. If I don't get into one that I respect and one I want to go to, I will go to Melbourne, I will start an arts degree, and I'll figure out from there what I want to do. That year I got into VCA. I started, so I was 19 when I started at VCA. I graduated when I was 22. And through that time, it was a very challenging experience in many different ways, as I think it always is for most people, both in the fact that developmentally you're going through your young adulthood, which is, you know, at its crux, a time where you're trying to work out who you are, what you want to be, what you want to do. And at that time, and I think this is true of a lot of creative people, it's a fully immersive experience and it starts to really strongly bind with your sense of self and who you are and what you want to do and what you want to be. So you can't imagine doing anything else because you're doing it 40 hours a week if you're in a drama school environment. Or if you're not in a drama school environment, you're investing so much of your money, time, effort, you know, appearance, everything into pursuing this idea. So I did that. Then this has become a very long answer.
I'm sorry.
It's the whole narrative. So then I graduated and I worked as an actor for 2 years and then I stopped. And this is where what you aptly asked in the question is very right. Because I stopped because I realized the job of being an actor wasn't right at all for me. That I was so dissatisfied in so many different capacities that even when I had a good job or something I thought I really wanted to do, I wasn't enjoying it and it was eating away at me. And that was for a multitude of different reasons, but a big part of it was what the form of the job was, because I realized I always felt so uncomfortable. I don't know how you feel about this. I always felt so uncomfortable when I bowed and people would applaud.
I hate it.
And I remember my partner at the time saw me in a show and was like, you always look so awkward. You look like you're in pain when you bow. And I was like, because I am. I've done my job. Like, I've done the thing that they have paid to see me do. You know, someone does your accounts and people don't stand up and applaud you. Or like someone does, you know, someone makes you a meal and you might thank them, but you don't, you know, applaud them, that sort of thing. And there was something really excessive or gratuitous. There was something about that that didn't sit well with me, alongside the fact that I didn't need the expression. That's something I've seen in a lot of particularly performers, is this burning need to express that they don't really, you know, whilst they'd obviously prefer to be, you know, treading the boards of the globe or doing something amazing, there's a need to express and to share. I never really had that, I don't think. I think I was often doing it for other people or because it was something that I found challenging and I wanted to get better at it, but not because it was something that I really needed to do. So when I stopped, and this is where it ties in, when I stopped, I really questioned, what is it that I want to do, or why was I drawn to this initially? One of my good friends, his ex, was a prolific and talented dancer, and they'd quit dancing. And they'd also gone through VCA many, many years ago, had worked around the world as a dancer, and they were now a writer. And the thing that they told me was, consider at the core what drew you to this in the first place and find a better job for that. And so I thought about it as well. And I went, okay, well, it's not about expression. And then I was like, maybe it's about storytelling. And then I sort of went, well, actually, for me, it's not as much about storytelling. Because whilst I think storytelling is incredibly important, that wasn't the driving factor for me. And you're entirely right. What I landed on was human behavior. That's what I was interested in. I was interested in both understanding my own behavior, the behavior of others, you know, the capacity of what humans can do to themselves and each other, how that plays out. And so, funnily enough, I gave myself a year to make a decision. It only took me 3 months, but I was actually tossing up between, which is funny for anyone that knows me now, was I was tossing up between horticulture and psychology. They were the two things.
And what's your side hustle at the moment?
What's my side hustle? I pay the bills with working with plants and I have a lot of plants myself.
So many plants.
And I spend a lot of time in the garden and that's all I really care about. In lots of ways. But so I was tossing up between those two things. And the reason I didn't go down the plant side of things was because I went, I think I'm going to get dissatisfied with the job element again. Mm. You know, the same as, you know, the parts of creativity that made sense to me were that constantly engaging with it, that constantly being challenged and forcing yourself out of uncomfortable situations and, you know, confronting big emotions or looking at a problem lots of different ways and trying to work through it, which I haven't practiced as a clinical psychologist. I hope to one day. I may end up going down a much more research-based capacity. But there's something in psychology for me that satisfies that element that I liked. So really, initially drawn to it more through circumstance and through, you know, probably just having a bit of an escape from a slightly mundane small town.
And also you were good at it. There was encouragement in, well, you you said, like you won awards. You were getting really good places in,
you know, the lead in all the school musicals, all of that
stuff. But yeah, like, so you were constantly being told essentially by people around you that that was something you were good at. And at a young age, it's hard to know what you want to do with your life.
Also, I had such a guilt about being really academic,
truly,
which is odd. I felt so embarrassed. Even now, I'm only, what, as a 26-year-old starting to overcome that shame and that tall poppy infused guilt of being
intelligent.
Well, yes, but being good at school or good at academia or things
it's not,
like that.
That's not encouraged by peers, particularly in primary school and high school. It's kind of, you're right. It's shamed and it's, you know, it's not cool to be smart or to like get really good grades.
Because you get othered by people and I think because of that experience and probably long-term as well, because of that othering, I wanted to pursue this because it was something that I was good at, that people, you know, you did get applause and gratitude for. Whereas previously, even though, you know, potentially, arguably, I was better in academia than I was at least as an actor when I started, that was something that was challenging. So it felt satisfying for me, but also it didn't feel as shameful as just pursuing academia. Reality is, maybe if I'd gone to Melbourne for that 1 year, the way I always articulated acting or theatre making or a creative practice was it was something I wanted to run out of my system. And I was like, I don't know if that'll take a year, it'll take 10 years, it might take 100 years. If I live forever, it might be forever. I didn't know the long-term trajectory of this, but I can definitely say I did run it out of my system by the point that I stopped acting specifically, because I still did a couple of creative things and I still do some creative things still. It had been run out of my system and what I had needed from it had been satisfied. And so subsequently it wasn't improving me or it wasn't growing or it wasn't developing me as a person. So yeah, I left.
Was there specific moments or situations that you were in that also kind of affected that decision? Or made it a little bit clearer that it wasn't for you?
Yeah, there was a situation maybe a year before I stopped that I had been called back for several paid roles, which was big. So if I'd got these, which I'd done these, you know, big callbacks, they had asked me my opinion of the other actors, you know, to get if we would work well together, I had been kept back for these extended periods of time. Everything had been really positive. And would have been a year of paid work, which, you know, for anyone who's just graduated drama school or been out for a year of paid work is the bloody bee's knees, like is the best thing you could possibly ever get.
In reality. It can be up and down.
Yeah. So it was that. Then the 1 month between those gigs was a show that I had initially been asked. Well, I had been part of the reading process and the developmental process when it had been at VCA and it was being put on. I'd been asked by the creatives if they could attach my name to the pitch. The pitch had been successful. So whilst I hadn't had an explicit conversation, I sort of understood that I probably would be doing that, was more waiting for the call. So anyway, I was waiting for these three calls that I was convinced were going to come. And A, none of them came, but B, I have found out that I did not have any of those jobs from people who were in the cast telling me that the creatives didn't have the respect to actually speak to me, the human that this implicated, who was looking at this going like, well, I'll have to leave all my jobs or I'll have to do this or my whole year's about to be different. I didn't get a single email, not a single call, not a text message. It was people in those casts telling me that I hadn't got it. That the only people who respected me enough to be honest were the other actors and none of the creative teams. And I went, this is not an, you know, and at the time as well, I was devastated. And I realized that one of the fundamental problems I have with the creative industry, specifically performance, I can't speak to visual arts and sort of other mediums and that sort of thing, but within the acting sphere is how common it is for the creative team, the people who, you know, inverted commas, have the power, and by power I often also mean money, don't treat the actors with dignity and respect. And I went, that's not an industry I want to spend my time investing in. So that was a pretty clear moment as well. There was also an instance of a show that I was in that I was having an awful time. And objectively, this was one of the, you know, A, more successful, but B, you know, bigger projects that I did as a creative person. I was in the throes of like a full depressive episode that I would, you know, go to rehearsals, I would come home, I would lie on my bed and look at the roof. And I would do that. And, you know, partner at the time would, you know, try and help me and help me through it and all of that sort of stuff. And then I would go to rehearsal, I'd do another day, and I'd come home and I'd lay there staring at the roof. And there was, whether it was intentional or not, I don't know. I've never been able or never felt comfortable and never been able to have a discussion with the people that were directly involved in this. But I didn't feel the necessary support to help someone through a circumstance like that, that was deeply embroiled in the creative process. It wasn't me separately having this depressive episode as Nick the human. It was depressive episode as Nick the actor because of the show that he's working on. And there wasn't sufficient support to either help me manage that if it were, you know, because that's the thing, it may not have gone away during the season or something like that. We still have to get through it. But that was pretty shocking and I felt pretty disheartened, and shortly after was when I sort of made the call. But that was also, I think, a motivating factor specifically to go into psychology and to go into therapy and feel a sense that I can help people, was, you know, firsthand I'd experienced the shortcomings of independent theatre and underfunded bodies and people not having the tools or the money or the time or the capacity to actually support people through the reality of what this job was. So, you know, potentially that's where some of my, that's where the importance for equipping people to manage these things for themselves comes from in me, and probably why I emphasize education so much and why I emphasize these sort of areas and things, because I experienced that and, you know, fortunately I got through it and I'm a much better person, and, you know, maybe long term it's led me to some really wonderful things. But at the time, awful.
I'm so sorry that you experienced those things, because that is devastatingly unfair. And also, you're right, like there needs to be a different way of handling creatives on a project or other humans that you interact with within the industry, or people that, you know, if you are on the creative team, there is a level of respect that you need to have for people who are working essentially for you. And I know you know this, but you were one of the only people that I went to during a time where my anxiety was directly related to the project I was working on, and that it was being dealt with horribly, and my mental health was of no concern to the people who were in charge of the team that I was working with. And that was a project that went for a long time. And the comeback from that experience, my mental health comeback from that, took just as long as the period of time, if not twice the amount of time that I spent on that project. Like, it's so important that people have like an understanding of mental health and how it can derail a person's life, essentially, if it's not, you know, if there's no support and no understanding of what's going on. I wonder if, and this is a very hypothetical question,
yes,
that if your experiences within the arts were different, or if the industry was more open to kind of being focused on and taking care of the well-being of people involved in the arts, do you think that you may have made a different decision or stayed a bit longer within the arts? Or?
I think I would have stayed longer. I think I would have reached the conclusion sooner.
Yeah.
I would have, I think I've thought about this quite a bit, and I think I would have still realized that this potentially wasn't for me, and I would have moved on from that capacity. I may still have worked more in a creative capacity, or I might, you know, might have moved into another job. I really enjoy doing lighting design. I really enjoy like dramaturgy type work. So I might have just migrated into a different sphere. But I think with the experiences that I had, to me, that was it is more pressing that I do something very legitimate and something very direct to address those circumstances.
you know, the other discomfort I think I had with being a creative was at times, and this is not to say that the world doesn't need creatives. The world needs mm-hmm. creatives more than anything else. We need people who are equipped in empathy, in storytelling, in compassion, in understanding human behavior, in not judging people. These are all skills that are desperately needed. But in terms of me as a creative, I felt very much powerless in the packaging that I had. As I was contemplating today what I was going to say, I think I was watering some tiny little ficus elasticas. Ficus elastica, it's a new cultivar called Yellow Gem, and they're beautiful. Anyway, I was watering them and I was sort of thinking, I was like, God, okay, well, what, you know, the question was just why, you know, why and how and what would I do differently and all of those sort of things. And I think the realization I had was if I was doing it differently, if I'd gone through a different experience, yes, long term, I would have realized these same things, but it would have been more enjoyable, it would have been healthier, and it would have been a natural evolution rather yes. than
a, like a hard corner, like a hard turn.
Nosedive into yeah. the bottom of the pool yeah. to then scramble my way out.
Yeah.
To gently touch as well on your experience, just for the logistics as well. So some of my experiences came from, you know, higher end independent work, whereas your experience was coming from objectively professional spheres.
Yeah.
Also just to, you know, to clock our differences, like I am a cis middle class male, you are a cis middle class female. It's like we objectively are the more privileged yeah. and the less specified of people within our industry. And this is the experience that is common.
Yeah, it's common. That, and that's why I wanted to share that that is something that I had talked to you about
yeah.
and that it was an experience that I had because it is common. Yeah. You and I both sat together and talked about our experiences yeah. and were like, this has happened to both of us. Our yeah. mental health is fucked
yeah.
because of these different power dynamics and whatever it yeah. was.
And objectively, where we come in from the category that is, you know, top of the privilege chart.
Yeah.
So think of everyone underneath that
yeah.
that is still trying to claw their way up in terms of representation, in terms of work, mm-hmm. in terms of all of this stuff mm-hmm. that has a more complex relationship with being within a power structure, being within those spaces, mm-hmm. you know, things need to fundamentally shift. And in some places they are, and in some circumstances they are, but I think there's needs to be a fundamental reorientation as to what the responsibility of anyone that puts on a show does in whatever capacity. If it's, you know, getting a couple of mates to read your new script, or if it's putting on a full-blown production where everyone's getting paid, there needs to be a clear understanding of how that affects the person, because the job of a creative, at least in my interpretation, there are people for whom it is very different. Part of that is to invest so fully yourself into that job. You know, even from a logistical standpoint, you can't necessarily go and, I don't know, party all night if that's something you wanted to do, because you still have to rock up on set at 6 a.m. the next morning. You know, you can't take more work that might make you more money when you're in an independent production because you need to rehearse for it. There are very logistical things, let alone the emotional investments you have to make. Because, I mean, anyone who's ever performed knows. You think about it 24/7. If you're one of those remarkable people that can switch off, my Lord, you should be running the country, because that's an incredible skill to be able to switch it on and switch it off. Another skill that I think people should be taught. However, for most people, you think about it constantly. You think about how you were in rehearsal yesterday. How would you say that line differently? What's that character going through? What was that performance that you saw that you think you could actually glean something from? And, oh, I need to rewatch that film. It becomes an all-encompassing experience. And I think for some people, at least, that's what creates the best work. But at other times, it's treated like, I don't know, a temp job. That they're like, oh, well, you're only going to be here for 8 weeks, so it doesn't really matter if you have a bad time. And obviously, that's not the experience for everyone. Obviously, it's not every project and every circumstance, but it is far too common to not be taken seriously and not to cause fundamental shifts in how people engage creative people.
So you're obviously super versed in like the social and political issues that surround mm-hmm. the arts and also like many other facets of society.
Right.
But do you think that that came from your time within the industry, or do you think that a step back and viewing from the outside and maybe even taking off the pressure of wanting to get a job has allowed you to become more vocal? Or I'm just really curious about that.
So I think I'd always been interested in the world and the impact that we have and things. And I think that was part of the initial appeal of storytelling, especially to, you know, go into other experiences that weren't my own and live in them and make, not necessarily judgment, but make comment on those circumstances. However, 100%. The moment I stepped out of it and it wasn't an investment, it wasn't, you know, if I went to see a show, which I didn't for a long time because it was too much for me to handle to go to live theatre after I stopped. If you're in a foyer and you saw someone who has any level of power, if you spoke to them, it was a conversation. It wasn't a, oh, I need to impress this person, or that person might give me a job, or maybe I'll work with this person one day. None of that was there. You just had the conversation as yourself. So when I stepped out of it and when it became, I'm engaging with this just as me, just as a person with opinions and a brain and flaws and inadequacies and areas of lack of knowledge and areas of knowledge, I looked at all of these things and went, we need to do better. We simply need to do better. And that's true across lots of industries. I don't think the arts is necessarily unique in that capacity. You know, talking about education, I think we need to do better in terms of education. I think we need to do better in terms of healthcare. I think at a fundamental level, I'd like to see a lot of westernized countries, you know, which is the only sort of demographic I can comment on, putting more emphasis on kindness and compassion and actually having empathy for the differences that we all have in our lives and letting that inform experience and jobs and structure. We're so subservient to this, you know, this omnipotent capitalist system of time is money and the human is a secondary byproduct for that. And the only time we worry about these things is if it means that, you know, it's going to cost us money. You know, as I was saying before, I don't think it should come to a crisis point before we start intervening in these issues. I think it needs to become a fundamental part of the fabric. So yeah, when I stepped out of it was when I started to go, okay, what are the bigger issues? My leaving is this hugely intersectional moment in my life. How do I unpack that? What were the powers at play? And then for me as an individual, it was going, okay, well, what do I also have the skill set to help prevent this happening again or help make the overall circumstance better? Because, you know, I'm someone that a big drive for me is wanting to help people and wanting to better circumstances and wanting to improve and leave something better than when I entered it. And I went, okay, well, what can I do? And for me, I think, you know, what most aligns with my skills and what most aligns with my interests is pursuing psychology and understanding how the brain and behavior works, hopefully one day to actually make positive impacts in these sort of spheres and positive impacts for people who are suffering, but also positive impacts in terms of the very structure and fundamentals of how we engage with people and how people are utilized in different spaces.
Did you have to battle any stigma around your leaving the the arts? Yeah. How did that
100%, go down? 100%. That people either viewed it that I had failed or that I had given up or that
that's
I just...
That's it though, isn't it? Like that's what we're taught and what society tells us is that if you stop on a path that you've been following, it is a failure or it is, it is a quitting of...
The way that I frame it for myself is that... So this is the thing. Look at any behavior, look at anything we do as people, whether it be eating toast in the morning or going for a run or, you know, being at a job. If it stops serving you in whatever capacity, whether that be financial, whether that be in terms of internal satisfaction, in terms of anything, the people who care about you will say, stop doing it. Why are you doing it? You can do something else with your life. Why are you investing in this thing that's causing you harm? And I realized that my investment in this, in pursuing a creative career and a creative life was causing me harm, was causing me individual harm, was also then inadvertently causing harm to those around me. So I went, why am I doing this? I mean, I've spoken to you explicitly about this as well, which for anybody listening, my legal name is Nicholas Clark. It wasn't the name I was born with. I was born Nicholas Mark Connolly. My parents got divorced, which took a very, very long time. And I changed my name to be with my mother's maiden name because I don't align with and I don't condone or accept the behaviors and the actions of my father. And I didn't want to carry his name anymore. same as in this. There was backlash. There were people going, oh, you're going to regret it in the future, or, oh, if you only gave it a bit more time, or you haven't thought this through enough. And I said, ironically, you sitting opposite, not you specifically, but person sitting opposite me making those comments, I've thought about this much more than you have. Mm-hmm. You know, your comment is coming from your perspective. You're projecting that idea on me. In reality, I've thought deeply about this, and I'm doing something that I know that lots of people won't understand necessarily in the first instance, but also will think, you know, will have a judgment of. But the reality is I've got to look after myself, and I've got to do things and make a positive impact in my own life, and hopefully then by extension make a positive impact in others. So yeah, people said, oh, you just need to, you know, just find a new agent. That's all it was. You need to find a new agent. Or, you know, you had a bad run, but it's going to get better. Or, oh, you're going to start getting work when you're 25. Like, you'll start getting professional paid work. So just stick it out for a bit longer. Or, you were so good at uni, like, keep going with it. And there are plenty of people who are brilliant at lots of things that don't do it as their job. And the reality for me was that the career and the pursuit of it was causing me so much individual harm that I went, this is not what I need to do. Actually, the best thing for me to do is to stop that and really consider the circumstances and really understand what has led me to this moment and this, at the time, sort of crisis point, and work out what's the best way I can move forward. And I think, as we were saying, I think people, acting especially, but any sort of performance or creative enterprise really, is so ingrained into people's understanding of who you are, and often for people is an ingrained understanding of who I am, who, you know, this is me, this is what I do. When the reality was, and I mean the reality is as well now, it's I look at myself and I go, I can't understand every element of me. It's something that I did for a while. It's just as true or just as important as what I'm doing now. Both things were important for the time that they were important, and then they go away. It's like relationships, you know. Sometimes they last forever. Sometimes they last for a small amount of time. They often teach us something really important about ourselves, and they often speak to a certain period of our life and how we were. But there's no shame in moving on. There's no shame or there's no problem in realizing that something isn't serving you and deciding to make a choice for the betterment of yourself and your life and those around you.
It's interesting that you got so much backlash, because I feel like, I mean, my observation of you now compared to when you were acting is like, it's almost like I'm sitting across from a different person.
Yeah.
Like, you are so happy now. Like, and you're so light and you laugh at everything. I remember the first time I saw you after you made this decision, and I saw you with Lee and I were together, and we had run into you, and we both walked off and we were like, Nick was laughing at everything. Like, he's so happy. Like, you kind of never used to do that. Like,
no,
you
had I used to be so serious.
Yeah. And you had this very like dark,
yes,
like sense of humor and like this just,
I mean, I still have a dark sense.
You still have it. You still have that essence about you. But there's also like this lightness that I feel like has come since the letting go of this quite complicated relationship almost. With
the word toxic.
Yeah. It was a toxic relationship. For sure. Yeah. It absolutely was. And I find it interesting that so many people gave you words of wisdom to just stick with it, because you are so, my observation again, like, you seem so much more content now.
Mm-hmm.
And those people that are telling you that you should have stuck with it, like, how do they feel?
Oh, I don't with speak their to them choices, anymore.
But also like
at a fundamental level as well. I don't believe that I have the authority to tell anyone what they should or shouldn't do with their life.
Mm.
I can offer my opinion and I can say, this is my opinion, this is why I think this. But at its core, all I care about for someone is, you know, are you healthy? Are you happy? Are you pursuing something that you're enjoying and getting fulfillment out of? And, you know, even to a lesser extent, like, do you feel like your capacity is being used well? And I say that very particularly because there's a bit of a like capitalist idea that, you know, if you're capable of doing something, you should be using it. That's not true. For instance, or at least when I was young, I haven't done it in years, I was a visual artist for a huge portion of my like youth and teenage years. And I was considering going doing visual arts, not performing arts. I haven't done that in years. I probably still have some skill set in it, but just because I'm good at it doesn't mean I want it to be my job. Doesn't mean I want it to be my life. Doesn't mean I want to, you know, suffer through whatever experience that is. Yeah, I don't think it's up to people to decide what people should or shouldn't do with their lives, but rather to support them through those decisions and find whatever specific circumstance really serves that person.
Is there a response that you got or something that you would rather have received in that time that would have just felt a bit nicer than people telling you what they thought you should be doing?
I think it was the people who just said, you know, well, one, good on you, but they were like, you know, are you enjoying it? Are you happy with the choice? Do you feel like it suits you more? That's all I really, they were the people that really spoke to me and really helped me through that. Because, you know, whilst now I can look back on it and have, you know, very firm opinions and very strong ideals on what I was doing and why I was doing it, you know, I'm not some titan. I'm just as, you know, fallible and flawed and malleable as everyone else. So yes, I'd made this decision and I do have a propensity to make strong decisions and then just go from there. In a sick way, I do sometimes love the experience of starting something and being the absolute bottom of the ladder and then having to climb your way up. So I think the people that supported me when I did just hit that rock bottom, make this big decision, you know, and let go of the past 6 years of my life to some capacity, those people really helped me. And the people who also listened and asked why, not in a judgmental way, not in a blocking way, not in a disbelieving way, but were like, well, why have you come to this circumstance? Do you think that this was a good idea? Do you think this will be long term? The people who actually listened, they were the ones that really helped me through that and really helped me, I guess, to, and, you know, very right, hit a level of contentment and enjoyment with what I'm doing with my life now. I think the only comment I would like to make from my experience is I think it's really, really important for creative people to develop a robust sense of who they are in lots of different capacities. And I've recommended this to people, not necessarily creatives, but certainly to a few. You know, when you suffer a rejection or when you, you know, experience a hardship, to go and do something that brings you unequivocal joy and makes you feel like you. So, i.e., if I have a really bad day, I do some gardening, or I'll like go and do some stuff with plants because it makes me feel good, or I'll watch like some silly drag queens doing some comedy on the internet. You know, I'll do things that just make me laugh. That's really important. I'll do things that make me feel like myself, that remind me that I am more complex than one experience. You know, I am a brother. I am a partner. I am a gardener. I am an ex-actor. I am, you know, all of these different things. But at the core of it, I am me. And just because one thing's not going well on a particular day doesn't mean that everything else isn't going well, or I don't have other skills or other strengths or other abilities that make me worthwhile and important as a human. So if you've had a bad audition, go and like bake some cookies or something.
That's literally what I do though.
Yes.
I'm a baker.
Yes.
So if I'm having a shit time.
And your baking is like very good.
I make food. And a lot of the time I make food for others because that makes me, it grounds me and it makes me feel like I'm giving and it makes me feel good.
Yes.
Yummy cookies.
Yes.
I feel like that little spiel that you just had could also be something that could be added to like the Australian school system. Like,
oh, hugely.
You know, like teach people that they have autonomy over their own lives and over who they are as a human being.
They have worth outside of their jobs. Like the first time.
Oh my God, the pressure. When you talk to someone who's in year 12 and they're like, I have to do these exams. I have to get a job. I have to go into uni and get a specific score to like get into this specific thing. I'm like, it doesn't matter. it truly doesn't. Yeah. Like you can do anything.
Also, it's like, okay, so you are, you know, you are 18 and you want to be a doctor and you don't get the score. There are multiple pathways that you can end up at that point, and none of them need involve you having an identity crisis.
Absolutely.
There's nothing wrong and there's no shame in taking your time or ending up at a point when you end up at that point. You know, I was thinking about that the other day, that the full course that I'm probably going to go down, if I do end up being a clinical psych and a registered clinical psych here in Australia, I will be 32. somewhere between 30 to 32 when I start practicing. Now, if I had decided to do this straight after I left school, I would be in like my mid-20s when I was starting that job. And what person wants to listen to someone in the mid... Well, ironically, you're listening to someone in their mid-20s. Tell them how to
No, I'm nodding along. I feel this very strongly as well.
But yeah, that I was like, I would be the age I am now offering people advice. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, sure, I can offer some element and I would have some skills.
But all of your life experience would be you studying
out
of books.
Whereas now I bring... Being
a destroyed
and heartbroken
artist,
miserable failure of an artist, and I bring all of that.
This concept came to me in my yoga teacher training. This idea of like self and the things that you do not actually being you. So this idea of like when someone asks me, "Hey, what do you do?" and I say, "I'm an actor." Mm. That's defining me myself. As what yes. I do, not as something that I do. I don't know if I'm making sense, but like how I could respond to that is, oh, I act or I record a podcast or I draw, I write or I walk along a creek. Like it can be anything. Like,
so I always frame it when people ask me, what do? I say I pay the bills with horticulture and I study psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And explicitly in that, I haven't said, I am this. I haven't been reductive and defined myself as one thing. I've been like, here are two things that I do. The really, and maybe this reveals my privileged private school upbringing, but it's like, for me, I remember being so angry at high school when people would identify themselves as rowers. And that's because I came from a school that was like, did really well at rowing.
Yeah.
But there was very much like the I'm a rower type attitude.
Right.
And there was something in that even from that young age, I was like, why are you reducing yourself down to what is in effect an activity?
Mm.
A job is an activity. You can say that you act or, oh, I'm a creative. That's a little bit better in sort of, you know, for my ear to hear because I'm like, oh, okay, you're introducing someone.
It's like an
active
thing that entirely. You do. It's not necessarily how you define yourself.
Yeah. If you ask me how I define myself, I'd be like, I don't know, I'm a very weird little human on a spinning planet that really likes plants and really thinks people are interesting.
But isn't that more truly like who you are rather than totally.
I don't know.
A budding psychologist or whatever it may be. Yeah, I think about that sometimes as well when I'm like in a bout of like anxiety that it's like I am not my anxiety. I am not my mental health issue. I have this thing that I deal with and that I live with.
Yeah.
And that sometimes is harder to deal with than it is on other days when it's kind of non-existent. But it's like if I were to define myself by my anxiety, which I did for a long time, it becomes very hard to then separate yourself and kind of acknowledge or notice the times when that's not actually how you're feeling.
I make a lot of jokes about my depression and it's interesting seeing how people respond to them because lots of people, and especially if they've experienced some level of depression in their lives, will laugh along with me. However, there are some people that are really like, are you okay? Are you going all right?
Or like, and I'm like, you shouldn't say that.
Yeah, or like, you know, you shouldn't say that. And I'm like, no, if I don't make and this is obviously different. This is not a blanket rule for how to deal with these things. But for me, if I start treating it with this, you know, level of reverence or this incredible power, then that's debilitating and I'm going, all I am as a person is this. I joke about every other element of me as a person. I joke about what I study. I joke about my upbringing. I joke about what I'm good at. I joke about what I'm bad at. Why is this any different than any other part of my person? It's something I am with. It's something I manage and engage with and, you know, good days, bad days, all of that sort of thing. But it's not all of me. And it's also nothing to be ashamed of. It's a natural extension of what it is to be human. The difference is the majority of the time we've been grown up in conservative worlds where you have to be perfect all the time and perfect at everything and all you have to be as a human rather than going, I'm a human, I'm an imperfect thing that has been constructed in a world I will never fully understand myself. And rather what's more important is what I do with my time and how I feel about that and how I feel about myself. To my mind, that's all that really matters. If you can do those things, my mother always used to say this and I've always stuck by it. She always said at the end of the day, you only have to live with yourself. And for me, that's been such a powerful and such a salient way to interpret your actions that it's like when push comes to shove, when all the other people are gone, when everyone's gone to bed and it's just you and your thoughts, if whatever you've done in the day, you go, yep, I did that and I'm okay with that. You don't have to feel, you know, super positive about it. But if you can sit there and go, yes, that's what I did. I did the best that I could with the circumstances that I've been given, you will live a fulfilling life. Mm. So cheers, Georgie. It's a good one.
I love that.
She's incredible. Mm. And it was such a thrilling way to be raised as a child, because ironically, for someone who was so perfectionistic for so many years, that was probably the one counterbalance to those incredible perfectionistic tendencies, was someone just being like, in all actuality, push comes to shove. If you're content with it, if you feel okay with it, that's all it needs to be.
Do you still have a creative outlet?
Yeah, I think so. I still consider myself to be a creative person, but my creative outlet has changed significantly. Yeah, for me, it's about growing and gardening and conceptualizing space through horticulture, which is a really wanky way of saying it's like I want everything to look pretty. But there's something as well about like relationship to light and to natural elements water and things like that. They're all very pragmatic grounding things. I was talking to my second cousin at Christmas over Christmas. And Karen is a phenomenal person, and she's an artist as well. She's a full-time painter, has been for the past 30-odd years, prolifically successful, talented, all of those things. Absolute bat of a human, like incredible. But we were talking about gardening, and she's someone who's lost both of her parents. She doesn't have a partner and hasn't for the past sort of 10-ish years. Her partner at the time passed away of leukemia, you know, love of her life gone. And we were talking about the power of gardening and how at so many moments of crisis or so many important moments in our lives, that just being in the garden has grounded us in such a deeply moving way, and how important that is. So that's in some ways my creative element. I also quite like cooking, and I'm not good at cooking for myself, so cooking for other people is good. But I feel like the creativity has just synthesized into the other elements of my life. So the way that I approach, say, psychological research or presentation or understanding is in a different way to people who maybe don't have a creative background, who come from a more scientific background, because it is quite sciencey. You know, the way that I engage with my job is different. The way that I look at the world is different. So whilst it's not maybe as explicit as it was once upon a time when I was, you know, getting a script, picking it up, interpreting a character, doing all those things, it's more implicit in all of my activities. I feel both more like myself, but ironically, I feel more creative as a person because it's just a part of me and it's just part of how I engage. And I'm surrounded by so many creative people, and I've been able to do other creative things that really satisfy me. So yeah, so it's still there. It's just not, maybe just not in a form that satisfies anyone but myself.
What's the thing you're most proud of doing in your creative years?
Okay.
Also since then as well. Is there something that you're like super proud of?
Ironically, I'm going to say two things.
Please.
I'm most proud of.
I'll give you that.
And funnily enough, both of them are after I quit. They're probably the two most fulfilling jobs I have done. Both of them I was paid for. And ironically, both of them I was doing lighting design and operating for it. Doing the lighting design and operating Stock Take Bitches in Business by the Daughters Collective, performed by the remarkable, sophisticated, intelligent and otherworldly Naomi Clemens and Ellen Marning, and doing the same sort of job for Poopy Tum Tums, which is Hot Department, which is Patrick Donan Silver. And what's on the surname? Oh, my God. She's going to kill me. I hope she kills me. I'm a terrible person.
Wolf. On a wolf.
Oh, my Lord. I knew that. An honor if you're listening. You can just slap have one of my kidneys if you need it.
They have one of my kids. I will give you my
have sperm. Them. Have my firstborn. So Patrick and Anna. And I think because it allowed me to just feel an overwhelming sense of pride for like my work, and my elements of those were sort of subservient to the incredible work that was on stage and that the performers were doing. Both those sets of people are some of the most thrilling, wonderful, funny, intelligent, brilliant people I've ever worked with. And the very honor and privilege of doing something like that was, I think, what I'm actually most proud of.
Thanks so much, Nick.
That's all right.
Thanks for being here. Thank you for speaking so openly about what was a big experience.
Yeah.
For sure.
Thank you for A, having me, but B, creating a platform where people can speak really openly and frankly about creative life and what it is to be someone that engages with that world for however long that you do. It's fucking amazing and super important. So thanks for letting me be a little part of it.
Oh, that was a big one. A lot of mental health chat, psychology chat, industry chat, but I think all things that are super important to be having conversations about. And Nick is one of those people where you can be talking about the most serious thing, but he just holds you in his little hand and keeps you safe from harm. Makes you feel like it's okay, you're safe. I want to say a huge thank you to everyone who has been sharing the podcast on social media and messaging me and letting me know which episodes you've been listening to and what's been resonating with you. It's so, so wonderful to hear and is exactly why I'm doing this. It's to have open and honest conversations with creative people about our experiences in this world. And with all of you listening, it makes me feel like something really special is being built. So thank you. Feel free to like, review, share an episode. I love that shit. That's amazing. Thank you so much to wonderful Rick Scully, who created all of the music for the podcast. I will chat to you again soon. Stay creative.